previously on Popping Collars.
Yeah, and it's important to note that they won the Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for adapting The Odyssey, of all things. Right? Who has the, to quote the Virginia state lawmaker from a few weeks ago, who has the chaputzpah? the chutzpah, right? To adapt The Odyssey. Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture, the show where priests, pastors, ministers, and religious thinkers from around the country weigh in on what people are binge-watching, tweeting about, trolling on message boards, and celebrating on blogs. My name is Greg Knight. I am in Palm Beach, Florida. I am a guy that has listened to Frozen in the front seat of my van about 1,000 times, and I am your host of this roundtable conversation with our guests who this week include the returning from last time, Kyle Goodman from Statesville, North Carolina. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, Greg.
And the returning from several times ago, Holly McHale from Alameda, California. Hello, Holly.
Hello, Greg.
This is episode 15 of Popping Collars, and our topic today is Disney, specifically Disney princess movies. So Snow White ushered in a century or so of movies about women from humble beginnings becoming royalty, like an animated version of Kate Middleton. And as these movies have moved into the present day, some things about the narratives have changed, and some haven't. So my question to kind of get us started is, which movie stands out for you, and what is it about it that sort of hooks you into the story?
I'll go with the Little Mermaid, and I'll pick that one partly because it's the one I remember from my own childhood. Yeah, my sister was a big fan, and like a lot of those films, we just had them playing on repeat in my house growing up. And I think the thing that hooked me or hooked us about that film and kept us watching it again and again was just singing the music. I mean, the music is such an important part of really all of those princess films, and I think perhaps the way that folks connect. I mean, Greg brought up Frozen already, and that's sort of the classic example. I mean, how many times have we heard all of the Frozen music again and again and again? And I think movies like The Little Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast, I think something similar happened with those films. You know, just the music. I mean, I can still, maybe not the whole thing, but I can still repeat many of the lyrics to Under the Sea and Part of Your World. I mean, they're just sort of programmed in my brain just because they're always on. And maybe they weren't the things I would choose to watch, but boy, we watched them in my house.
Gosh, I think my interpretation of The Little Mermaid has changed so much since I became a parent. And now, like, now I see that movie whenever I see it through the eyes of King Triton. And recognizing that sometimes you can't control what it is that you want, desperately want your kid to be. You accept who they are and love them anyway. It's funny because I think good stories, you start to sort of see through the eyes of different characters.
Like Kyle, I have strong memories of seeing both Beauty and the Beast and Little Mermaid in the movie theater. And those soundtracks come on and I know all the words and sing along. I don't want to say this one because I'm so sick of it, but when I saw Frozen, and I saw it right when it came out, so I feel like I, you know, was early on this game.
You were in early.
And when Elsa sang Let It Go, like, I was actually crying in the movie theater a little. Just because I can see myself, or I'm holding my daughter who's totally scared of this movie, saying, can I go, can we go home? but wanting her to sing Let It Go. And then I also loved that Elsa didn't really let it go. I mean, she still couldn't control her power. So it wasn't, which I think is all of us as we want to release what holds us back. But it's not an instant. It's not instant. And but then I'm also annoyed at Frozen because Anna is clearly the better person here.
Well, she's the more interesting. Yeah, she's the more interesting character.
But and is it, did she save herself? Did she save her sister? I mean, it's kind of complicated, but how she, the end, I thought it was a good ending without being too sappy. It was kind of sappy, but you know, it's a Disney movie.
Yeah, that's another one where Disney is clearly moving in a more nuanced direction with the whole princess narrative, right? And like trying to take it down a different path. So where Frozen, you know, kind of inverts that idea of what is true love.
It's sisters, and it's, they're in charge of this kingdom, though I don't all the way understand that, but yes.
Right.
I think there's a big shift that has to happen with the role of a princess in this kind of film, and I know it's not a Disney film, but I'm sure I know exactly when that happened. And it's when the first Shrek film came out.
I was thinking about that.
And everyone's sitting there in the theater, and I'm catching on with this film. I'm figuring out what's probably going to happen. And yet, as I'm thinking about it as an adult, I'm thinking, wow, what if she... And spoilers here, everyone. Sorry if you haven't seen Shrek, but what if she turns out to be an ogre at the end of this film? And she does. And all of a sudden, that whole princess trope is, you know, everything before it is just over, isn't it? I mean, after the self-image and the self-worth statement that movie makes, can you go back to that old school Snow White, Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella princess? I mean, maybe you can go back to the skinny, pretty blonde girl with the long, flowy hair, but can you have the same type of character, you know, after the statement that movie makes? I don't think you can. I think it necessitates a nuanced character. Or it feels like regression.
I feel like Disney is kind of reclaiming a lot of the princess movies through the live action movies that they've been doing lately. You pulled out the big three, right? So Cinderella, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty. Those are kind of the big three kind of princesses that still exist in the Disney world. You know, Maleficent released last year clearly kind of redefined what Sleeping Beauty was about. Certainly Snow White and the Huntsman kind of redefined what that whole Snow White thing was about, like through the lens of like the Hunger Games.
But the Cinderella movie, I just saw it the other day. What fascinates me about that is there are little bits of feminism. It made me think about economics, that Cinderella could talk to a prince and she could pass. But it was the Cinderella story. There was no poking out of eyes, no cutting off of toes. It was Disney Cinderella.
So this is one of those topics that I think is kind of harder to weave back around into the religious world. Although I think that there are some things.
God, Esther.
Like, I don't know, maybe this is my world of like children and youth ministry, but I'm constantly trying to get kids to kind of connect to stories, you know, in the Bible, especially younger kids, especially like pre-K, kindergarten, first, second, you know, just trying to like understand characters, motivations, why people are doing what. And then, of course, like the Bible always goes totally weird in places. And so it's like you have to kind of edit the stories to make them palatable for children and stuff, and it makes me think of like these Disney stories and like how these kids just watch them over and over again. But Disney's doing the same thing, like they're adapting The Little Mermaid.
But isn't it in, I was thinking of like Fowler stages of development, because I remember before I had kids, like wanting to clean up fairy tales and Jonah and all that. But he talks about how at that age they have these fears and that they need to work through these fears, and so the Bible stories help them with these fears, and also they learn quickly that death and sex are things that they can't talk about. I was at the front, he has the books up front, and there's a book on Jesus dying on a cross, and a kid who's 7 who doesn't go to church is like, what's going on here? Why did he die? And I'm like, well, let me tell you why and how he died, and all was really into it. And then I looked at the parents, and I realized, I am not a Sunday school teacher.
It's a really interesting question, though, and I think a rich topic. I mean, I was thinking about Mel Gibson's The Passion of the Christ and how much I hate it. And I hate it, well, for a lot of reasons, but, you know, I've only watched it once, and just the brutality of it, I mean, I'm desensitized to a lot. I mean, a lot. I mean, I grew up on Pulp Fiction, right? But there's just something about that that I can't stomach. And yet it is the story. I mean, even, you know, even the parts of it that he's taking away the parts of it that are his editorial inviction. I mean, it's still the event itself. And how do we stomach the most brutal parts of our story? And I am interested in that, Greg, how we whitewash the Bible stories and our children's versions. I mean, I've got, because I got a lot of gifts when I had a little girl, I have about 30 different, you know, children's Bible, you know, illustrated Bibles and their versions. And, you know, most of them are 3 pages and have a smiling whale for the Jonah story. And, you know, there's palm branches and then Jesus raises from the dead. Oh, wait, how did he get there? You know?
Yeah, I have like my first Bible. It has the creation story, the Noah story, Jesus' birth, and then the end. You know, as someone that works with children and youth, I'm constantly trying to figure out what is it that's appealing to kids? Like, I was just reading an article on Episcopal Cafe, who features our podcast, and we love them. But I was just reading an article on their website about how Sunday school is kind of a dying education piece. Mm-hmm. That certainly education is necessary in formation, but so is worship, so is service, so are all kinds of things. But it's the method of education, sort of the Sunday school method of like, show up in a classroom, we have knowledge that we need to give you. You need to ingest these stories and make meaning out of them and be able to kind of internalize them and repeat them, or at least the morals of them, back to us. And here, while you're at it, here's some popsicle sticks and glue, and why don't you make something pretty that we can show your parents so that they feel like you've done something this whole time. And, like, I think that certainly there are some things that I agree with that, which is that, yeah, there are some pieces of this that feel like an outdated model, but certainly storytelling isn't outdated. No. I mean, that's what we do. That's evangelism. That's what we do as a community. So there's something about being able to tell these stories that have existed for millennia that I think is important. And yet that's such a tough connection to make, especially with younger kids who don't necessarily have a foothold into this biblical world. And yet these Disney stories, these fairy tales, these ideas of these princesses sort of overcoming obstacles and sort of realizing their specialness. Yeah, there's something scriptural about that, but they're much more compelling. And so I'm wondering, like, what do Disney princess movies have to teach us about how we can tell our stories, maybe in a more compelling way?
The thing that stands out to me is really, I guess, the thing that I started with, and that's maybe going back to music as a storytelling medium. I mean, say what you will about the musical, but, you know, are these films the same without music? Yeah. And so my question would be, you know, for Christian education, how do we or don't we use music to tell a story? Because I think that's an integral piece. And the music we have, I mean, it's fine. Jesus Loves Me, the old Sunday school songs, or maybe even some more updated, you know, in certain traditions and contexts, I guess, some of the praise and worship stuff. But how is it telling the story, or is it doing it effectively? Because when you sing Let It Go in the middle of that film, I mean, it connects, and it's repeated and repeated. But it is a huge hinge piece in the telling of that story. Yeah, so perhaps maybe there's a lesson to be learned about, you know, how we tell the story through different media. You know, is it music? Is it through drama? You know, how are we engaging our kids beyond, as Greg says, popsicle sticks and, you know, colored paper and, you know, stuff that parents proudly display on their refrigerator for a few weeks. But, I mean, is the story told?
So I oversee children's ministry, but I don't teach Sunday school. And talking to my children's minister, the thing that we keep coming back and forth is curriculum. And this sounds kind of doesn't always sound like it touches with princesses, but I think about princesses are out there, they're all over. But the curriculum, it's hard to find curriculums that make these stories connect with the kids.
Right. So we talked a little bit earlier about sort of the way that stories get whitewashed, right? Like, honestly, children's Bibles, if you've never seen one, go out and pick one up and try to find a good one.
Have you found the Spark Bible? I do like that one.
I used the Spark Bible.
It's not perfect.
In my pre-K kindergarten class, and one of the reasons that I use it is because it has more stories than most children's Bibles have.
Yeah.
That's the thing. It's like there's this picking and choosing that goes on, right? Mm-hmm. So there's like, well, we can't really do prophets with kids because kids aren't going to get Amos, right?
No one's going to get Amos.
Well, let's be fair. Did the adults read Amos either?
Just let the water trickle down.
So we're going to wipe that out. But then it's like even stories that it seems like should be kind of manageable for kids. Like I think Esther is a manageable story for kids. And yet it's kind of complicated.
Especially the intro where they kill everyone.
Yeah, it's like, so wait, she saved her people how? Like by ordering the execution of someone? Like, I don't get it. And it's like, just forget it. Just make noise whenever we say the guy's name. That's all you need to remember.
I mean,
it's like, we really kind of boil these things down to, like, make them as palatable as possible. But that's the thing. Like, we're talking about kids and children's Bibles and all that stuff. But these kids are the ones that eventually grow up, leave the church, and then come back to the church. And this is their understanding of church, are these kind of, like, soft-pedaled stories that we've given them during their sort of formation years. And, you know, you start to challenge adults with, like, well, maybe there's more meaning here. And they're like, you've totally thrown their what they thought religion or spirituality or the Christian life was all about. You've just sort of thrown it off track. Sometimes people struggle with that. Like, they just want it simple.
Well, that's a really good point. Why did Disney take out the birds pecking the sister's eyes out and cutting out
right.
her feet?
Or the Little Mermaid losing her voice?
Oh, yeah, she stays part of the sea.
You know, a lot of these Disney movies are based on Grimm tales,
mm-hmm.
right? Grimm tales always kind of end in a very particular way. And so Disney's kind of response to that was, we'll just take the beginning of the story that we really like, and then when it's about to get to the part where things are going to go really badly for the protagonist, we're just going to end the story and say, you know, use the tagline, happily ever after. Well, when it comes to Christianity, like, there is a happily ever after. There's a resurrection. But it's a resurrection that follows a crucifixion. And you can't really get to the Easter egg hunt without going through the Good Friday service. But the Good Friday service is a tough sell for kid. Like, there's some really sinister pieces to the Disney plot. It's just that nothing sort of bad happens to the princess, right? Like, everything kind of works out. And I think that's where it's hard for us to communicate biblical stories, because it doesn't always work out necessarily, especially Old Testament stories. It doesn't always work out for the people in those stories. And yet we have to kind of accept on faith that God is with these people, even in these dark times.
And, you know, I would argue that perhaps what's needed in our models for Christian education in light of that is not necessarily, you know, an overhaul in the sense of let's do away with these old models, but let's flesh them out a little bit. I mean, maybe you can tell the story of David and Goliath a certain way to your kindergartners and evolve that story a certain way as they get a little older. But then maybe, you know, to your middle schoolers and high schoolers, you start telling more of the story of David. You know, maybe by the time you're in middle school or high school, you can start to talk about, you know, David and Bathsheba and Absalom and really wrestle with the stuff that that guy wrestles with, you know, as his rule over Israel evolves and changes and his relationship with God evolves and changes from being more than just this young boy with a slingshot, you know, slaying a giant. You know, by the end, David's contending with himself. And I think that's a very relatable thing for a young person. And maybe that's partly where the ball is dropped, is we don't challenge kids at that age and in that level of experience with the stories as they are.
Like this idea of seeing stories through different characters' eyes, I think that that's something that kind of you get better at as you get older and kind of start to appreciate a story. So it's like revisiting the David story, but this time, what was Jonathan feeling?
Mm-hmm.
What was Saul feeling? Like, you can get at a story through a lot of different ways. Like, I always love, like, the calling of the disciples because they include the line about leaving Zebedee in the boat,
mm-hmm.
right? And this idea of what is being gained by the disciples choosing to follow Jesus and what's being lost, right? What relationship are you entering into and what relationship are you really severing?
Mm-hmm.
I see that story over and over again, and I just think about what is Zebedee feeling in that moment when his sons just drop their nets and leave. And that's your family. Like that's,
yeah.
And fishing is what your family does. And they just leave, right? That's got to be heartbreaking.
What a great story that would be for the context of a high school graduate and their family. And their family. To do as an education piece or, you know, to do in worship and to live into that. And, you know, what it means to leave the boats and the nets behind.
And you see that, like, that's actually, now that I think about it, a pretty recurring theme
mm-hmm.
in these Disney movies when the girls aren't orphaned. But you've got, like, you know, King Triton having to let go of Ariel. You've got, but Jasmine's dad.
Jasmine!
You know, this idea that she has to be who she is, and he can't fit her, you know, into whatever mold it is that he wants her to be.
Right. Or Rapunzel locked in the tower, or Sleeping Beauty locked away by her parents, so God forbid she ever see, you know, a spinning needle. And yet, in that story, that's the one thing that just ends up having to happen of all the things to happen to someone. You know, out of all the effort you could put forward to keep her from just touching that one thing, yet somehow, some way, it works out that she does the very thing. And I mean, that's so absolutely true to life for, and I think very relevant to the experience of a teenager. You know, it's that very thing you've been told a million times not to do.
And I was thinking from the other way of a parent, of how you can try to prevent them from touching that spinning wheel like her parents do. They hide them all, but still, you can't protect them.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's parenting is such a big piece of this because we all have daughters. That's probably an important thing to mention because that's one of the reasons that this topic, I think, is certainly swirling through my head. I imagine that it swirls through a lot of parents' heads of like, what is my child watching? What meanings are they drawing from what they're watching? Like, what are they internalizing about sort of body image? You know, how the world works, what it is that they're supposed to like, what it is that they actually like, you know, what kind of influences are sort of going into them. These movies have such a hold. Like, you know, I'm looking around my house right now and I see Snow White and I see Cinderella and I see Sleeping Beauty, who for some reason doesn't have a dress on, laying on the floor. I don't know what that's all about. But like, and you know, there's a giant Elsa doll over there. Like, I mean, there's she is totally enthralled. And I feel like, as a parent, that it's my job to help her make sense of what it is that she loves about this so much. I do think that these narratives, especially the princess narratives, have a hold over the sort of thoughts and meaning making of our children nowadays. And I think it's important for us to realize it and not just kind of like ignore it.
In our household, before Elsa came along, because I noticed my daughter, whenever she wanted to be a princess, I'd be like, when people asked her what she was going to be when she grew up, she was princess. I'm like, that's a title. What's the job? Princess of what? Are you a princess of a pilot? What are you? And then she discovered Elsa and she can be a queen and just be done with it all.
But I think that Frozen actually moves us in a really good direction. Because if you think about it, so Frozen is the most successful Disney movie ever in the history of the company. And it presents a unique take on the true love scenario of where true love can come from. And yet, you would think to yourself, here's a major Hollywood studio, Disney. They put out an animated film that presents a unique take on who can be a hero and what true love can be. And it makes more money than any other animated film ever. And yet, no one has thought to replicate this over the last 2 years. Like, you would think that this would be something that people would, like Iron Man only needed to do a little bit, and all of a sudden we have 10,000 comic book movies, right? Like, what in the world does Disney have to do to, like, sort of change up their thinking a little bit? And yet, you know, I think that certainly you're on a different path, right, as far as these stories go. And that's what they are. They're stories that reveal something about us.
What I loved about Frozen and the but it didn't seem that the marketing for Frozen, I didn't hear that compared to other movies.
Right.
It was very subtle. It was very, and then like only a couple of, it wasn't like their first weekend was this huge, it like slowly grew. It was just, I think they knew they had something magical and then they let it, and then they hit the stores with the marketing, but I don't think like they had enough Frozen dresses to begin with.
The summer after, which I guess was last summer, right? Is that right? We were at Myrtle Beach and, you know, in one of those Disney stores looking for, you know, gifts for our nieces and nephews, and there was no Frozen anything in the store. I'm like, we're walking in here, how can you not have any Frozen anything? And, you know, as it turns out, those things are sort of aftermarket, and, you know, all the Frozen merchandising really hadn't even hit. Yeah. You know, even the summer after with the popularity boom, I don't think they knew what they had on their hands with that film. And I wonder if that's a bad marketing read, and it speaks exactly to what you're talking about, Greg, about seeing a film that does not just simply parrot all the same tropes that have made these princess films popular before. And so what do we do with this? We don't know. Well, let's play up the silly looking snowman and the reindeer, which, quite frankly, are almost afterthoughts in that film. I wonder if they were added at some point in the thinking just to give, you know, the film a little more comedic relief or a little bit more of a connection point for little girls. And yet, ironically, you could take those things out of the film and would it still be the same movie? I think maybe.
You could take all of that. I love it, but you can take them out.
Yeah, I mean, as a matter of fact, you can make the argument in the storytelling that, I mean, it just doesn't even belong at all. At least the Jar Jar Binks of that film. I mean, isn't he? I mean, Ben can be Chewbacca, but Olaf is Jar Jar Binks.
Never gave me a chance. chance. I found her after a long 24-year absence. Like mother, like daughter, she say she like to dance. And like the first day of my birth, out my life she pranced. Birth father don't even know that I exist. The true mother couldn't conceive, she full of cysts. I almost died two times, had thoughts of slitting wrists. Don't know my heritage, life still full of twists and turns. Watch mom morph into a skeleton, the burn. From radiation, God was foretelling the urn. I would fill with dead parent, mind swelling, concerned about the cancer sticks, they still selling them. Ma lived, but daddy did die. I watched him go, we'll never forget the last breath there. When his soul was leaving every day to make sure that I could eat. Bear hugs and pure love, I cried for a week at his feet. Fighting for his honor, his pain, his generosity. Taught me to never judge and to value reciprocity. I feel his eyes looking down on me. You were the world to me. R.I.P. Daddy, R.I.P.
We've got to do our Go In Pieces segment. This is where we plug our Twitter feeds, our blogs, our websites, our churches, however it is that we can get in touch with people and however it is that people can get in touch with us. So, Holly, where are you working? What are you doing? And how can people get in touch with you?
I'm working at Our Savior's Lutheran Church in Lafayette, California. It's the church behind the car wash if you're in Lafayette. I'm the associate pastor there, so that means I do the cleanup work. I work with seniors, both children and seniors who are older, and anyone in between. You can get a hold of me through Facebook, Our Savior's, or email, or any, just Google me. I'm really famous.
All right. Kyle, where are you? What are you doing? How can people get in touch with you?
Sure. I'm Kyle Goodman, the pastor of Concord Presbyterian Church in Statesville, North Carolina. And you can find the church on the web at www.concordpresschurch.com, or you can find us on Facebook. You can also find me on Facebook, still not on Twitter, although I'm really thinking about getting a Twitter handle, mostly just for this show so I don't embarrass myself every time we go in pieces.
My name is Greg Knight. I'm the Director of Children and Youth Ministries at Bethesda by the Sea Episcopal Church in Palm Beach, Florida, where you can find us on the web at www.bbts.org. I don't know why I did the www. I think I was just copying Kyle.
Sorry.
Popping Collars, however, you can find all over the place. You can find us on the Facebook at Popping Collars. You can friend us or you can like us. You can find us at facebook.com/poppingcollars. You can find us on Twitter. We're at Popping Collars. You can find us on Instagram, Popping Collars Podcast. You can find us at our website, poppingcollarspodcast.com. You can email us, poppingcollarspodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us featured on episcopalcafe.com. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts, whether that be the iTunes Store, Stitcher, or TuneIn Radio. That is Popping Collars for this week. So thank you, Holly. Thank you, Kyle, for being here. And you can keep those collars popped. We'll see you next time.